Hey everybody, this is Bina 007 back for the 87th episode of the epic linear Song of Ice and Fire reread from the folks at Vassals of Kingsgrave, still clinging on even though Game of Thrones is now over. My name is Bina 007. I am your host for this episode. Super excited because today we're discussing three of the final chapters in A Feast for Crows, all of which are awesome. It feels like a long time since I've really loved all of the three chapters in discussion, but I am very excited about them. Today we're going to be talking about Reek 3, Theon 3 from Dance, Brienne 8 from Feast, and Cersei 10 from Feast. These chapters take place on the 16th and 17th of May, 300 AL, and these are in fact the last published Brienne and Cersei chapters in Feast, although we will get to more Cersei in Dance. So today I am joined for these awesome chapters by Abby.
Hi, this is Abby or Daisy Mormont on the forums.
By Dan.
Hey, this is Dan. I'm Witless Chum on the forums.
We also have James.
Hello, Queen James on the forums.
And by our stalwart peanut Jock.
Hello, my little Joe on the forums.
Okay, folks, so as usual, we are going to spoil potentially anything in A Song of Ice and Fire. If we do anything T-Wowy or Game of Thronesy, we'll do it in the after show and it'll be very clearly flagged up. Okay, so we're going to open this episode with Reek 3, Theon 3 from A Dance with Dragons. And with our chapter summary, we have Abby.
After 16 unsuccessful days of looking for phrase that may or may not have been ground up and baked into pies, Ramsay returns to House Stoat riding his horse named Blood because he is a bad guy. Reek is there to meet his master and his dogs. Ramsay seems to want to have some father-son bonding time with Reek and tries to play catch, but Reek really drops the ball or severed head due to not only having 8 fingers. To celebrate their lack of success, Ramsay hosts a feast in order to drive home how much of a bad guy he is and to piss off his allies by depleting their food stockpiles. And these feelings of animosity definitely won't come into play later when there's a power struggle eventually occurring over the rightful Warden of the North. The party is brought to a close, though, when Roose returns home unexpectedly, pissed off due to his teenage son doing what any teenager does when their parents are away, throwing a party. Roose kicks everyone out so he can talk to his son, but leaves Reek because we need a POV character there to tell us what's happening. Reek, learns Stannis has taken Deepwood Mott, and Roose gives Ramsay a kill them with kindness lecture on how to be a good lord. Roose then requests that he take Theon on a bonding trip and gives Theon elocution lessons, providing some nice parallels between Theon and Ramsay, one who started from the top and is now at the bottom, and the other who started at nothing and is now at the top. Then we get the backstory on the first Reek and the Ramsay and Emeric because Roose just really loves to dump exposition on us. Roose then explains his philosophy on leeching and tries to give Theon some fashion advice. The chapter ends with us meeting Lady Dustin in Barrowton. The end.
Very good. This is an epic chapter. I love this chapter so much. It is brilliant horror writing. I think I was Skyping you guys about just the way Martin uses language and metaphor. Just some of the phraseology is so beautiful. Abby, what did you want to draw attention to in this chapter, first of all, as it was yours? Why did you opt to do it? Because it's, in a sense, it's just so disgusting. I kind of shy away from it a little bit.
Theon is my favorite character, so I just like to talk about him a lot. And I just think I like this super depressing, angsty kind of stuff because I'm an emo child at heart. So this is right up my alley, I guess.
But this is more than emo angsty. I mean, this is proper horror. I mean, some of it. Catching a maggoty head that's disintegrating and with this,
it's pretty hardcore. I don't know. I like it. I think it's really interesting. I like the whole degradation, I guess, of that Theon goes through, and just witnessing that is really interesting to me. And I just find the whole Ramsay Roose dynamic really fascinating. So, yeah.
Yeah, I definitely get that. So let me restate a question I asked in the Skype thread. Yeah. What do you think is Roose's deal? Because he knows what Ramsay is. He seems to think that, like, he acknowledges that that Ramsay is horrific. He acknowledges that he's too feckless to rule. He thinks his own rule won't survive. He acknowledges that Ramsay's murdered his sons and will probably murder any future sons, and yet does nothing to stop this inevitable slide into murder and his own death. Is Roose Bolton, in a series with incredibly dark characters, the darkest, the most nihilistic, the most inexplicable and puzzling?
Yes.
Care to elaborate?
When I sort of look at Roose and kind of the way he is, I mean, it almost seems like, you know, he is very dark and he's very nihilistic, and he's almost like training himself to be even more dark and nihilistic just through kind of his philosophy of governing and lordship and everything like that. Like, although sort of when, you know, when he kind of goes through the, you know, his little spiel there about like, you know, Ramsay will try to kill them and blah, blah, blah. And I don't really feel too much about that. You know, I mean, part of that is just ruse, but part of it is kind of like, I think he's looking at it somewhat objectively and kind of thinking like, maybe I don't actually have a better option than this.
I thought he was just saying that because he knows that Bjorn is obviously Ramsay's sort of pet, so he was just sort of trying to sort of feed Bjorn information and might actually be planning against Ramsay in secret.
Oh, so you think he's bad-mouthing Ramsay to see if Theon will, if he can trust Theon?
Yeah, he's like sort of seeing what he can and can't tell Theon.
Oh.
Just testing him.
A bit like when Tyrion gave the dodgy information to three different people to see who was betraying him. Huh, okay.
Yeah.
Wow, okay. Well, that makes him slightly less dark. I mean, I still think that's a slightly odd way of testing Theon out. And as Abby said jokingly, the whole kind of like, we need to keep Theon around as POV. I find the whole thing a little bit silly. James, any thoughts on this character that is Roose Bolton?
I just think he definitely, I mean, the way that George writes him, it even seems like when he walks into the room, he just like sucks out all of the air out of the room. Like everybody just feels his presence immediately. And I know that there's been talk about, you know, like theory about Roose being a vampire or something like that. But when think about it, I read somewhere online that like there's a theory that Roose is a vampire. Have you ever heard that?
No.
It's a tinfoil fun. It's like the Varys is a mermaid theory. It's just like a fun thing people throw around.
But yeah, what's it based on? I mean, what is the tinfoil theory?
It has to do with the leeching and, you know, things like that. I can't remember exactly. It's very tinfoily. But I just go with that. Like, he kind of just reminds me of, you know, the great vampire that during a movie that would come in, that's like the final boss, you know, like, he doesn't have to show his power because you could just feel that he's powerful. And that's just the way that it seems like George writes him. Like, he doesn't really have to speak with a loud voice. He speaks under his breath, but everybody hears every word that he says. You know, I just like the way that he's written. I don't really know.
I love how you can be in this community for a decade and still there are beautiful, wacky theories that can surprise you. That's brilliant.
Yeah, I mean, I don't actually think that he is a vampire, but he just gives that vibe of, you know, the final boss vampire in a movie. But yeah, I also think it's really, I don't know how to think about it when he says that, you know, he has a feeling Ramsay's going to kill any sons that he has, and, you know, he likes his wife, but she's probably going to end up dead too, or something like that. It just seems like he's almost just like giving up to the fact that he knows that Ramsay is this monster and that's where his house is going to be. I just don't understand his thinking or, you know, why he would say that.
I kind of interpret Roose as a very pragmatic and fatalistic kind of guy. And when he's giving Theon the advice about leeching to like remove his bad blood, we know that Roose himself, or not Theon the Leech, maybe Ramsay, I don't remember, sorry, read this chapter like a week ago, to the leeching is to remove the bad blood, and we know Roose leeches, so maybe it's more he himself thinks that his own blood is bad, and he created Ramsay, who he thinks is a bad egg, so something along those lines. Maybe he just accepts it that he created this thing.
Do you guys find it credible, this character portrait of Roose? Do you think it's plausible that someone would be this nihilistic in this world? You know, he's a murderer, he kills people. So seemingly casually talking about his kids being killed. I mean, I love it. I think it's so dark. It's what we go to George for. And I loved it when I was reading it, and I thought it was deliciously dark. And then afterwards I was like, but is that?
There's such a difference between Roose and his character and any other character that we've met throughout the series. Most people are, you know, think about their family first and making sure that their line, you know, lives on past them. And then it seems like with him, he's got this bastard child that, you know, killed his only true born son. And he's okay with that. It just doesn't make sense with the world that we've learned. So that's why I just can't really make sense of his character. You know, we got to know Ned, who is, you know, 100% Stark and wants his line to keep going on. It seems like all the other characters, you know, Tywin Lannister's the same way. All these, you know, leaders of the houses seem to want to further their line, and then Roose is just, he seems different.
The way I sort of square that is, you know, I think in some ways Roose is a character who almost represents like the ambition of the great houses, like shorn of all the kind of personality and feelings basically that Ned has and Tywin Lannister has, you know, because those are both characters who did things because of their emotional attachments to people that really put their house in a bad way. You know, where because Tywin is so angry and hates Tyrion, he, you know, raises him to basically hate House Lannister and murder him. And, you know, Ned hides his sister's child, which could have ended, you know, completely ended the Stark line because he loved his sister so much. Whereas Roose doesn't really care about people, but he does care about, you know, preserving House Bolton. So he's just like, well, yeah, he killed my son. He'll probably kill my other sons. But I think he's the best option to keep the house going. So I'll just go along with this. Because I'm Roose and I don't have particularly strong emotions about things anyways.
But he does pride himself a little. I mean, there are echoes and symmetries here, aren't there, between Ned, Roose, Ned, and perhaps even Tywin. So the way in which Tywin tries to teach Jaime and Tyrion and Cersei about what it means to be a ruler and how to be successful as a ruler, and Ned is teaching his sons. And you sort of feel, Roose, you're setting yourself up to be clever. And you can see that Ramsay is being feckless by saying, you know, advising him you've got to marry Faye Carrier in Winterfell to seal your claim. But doesn't he realise that just putting this... I mean, he's got to know that putting a bastard as his heir, that the Northmen aren't going to go for that, especially one with his reputation. It just feels that on the one hand, he's trying to be this pragmatic, sensible, cynical ruler. On the other hand, it's almost delusional. And yet he's kind of aware of the delusion. It's working on so many layers, I find it almost like my head spinning at the end of this chapter.
Does he think of it just as sort of a... You know, he's basically taking a gamble that, you know, well, I don't think this will work, but maybe it'll work. And, you know, why not? Because I'm Roose and I don't have particularly strong feelings about anything.
All or nothing. He gave me really strong Denethor vibes for any of you Lord of the Rings fans out there. This idea of a secondary house who has maybe for centuries been second to the great house, so the Starks, or in this case, you know, you've got Denethor feeling that he's a steward, but he should be a king. And then this great chaos and war happens, and he almost wants to take a chance at being the ruler, or is greedy and hungry for power, even though he knows in his heart of hearts it can't work, and ends up just being this nihilistic, well, burn it all, kill them all, even my own son. And it really reads to me a little bit of that. I'm not sure if George was inspired by that in any way, but both of them, I think, are some of the most eerie and horrific pictures of nihilism in fantasy literature. And it's kind of weird because I think a lot of us think of Euron in that way, but this is really, to me, it's the worst. Partly because it does feel so kind of maybe implausible, illogical, and therefore, like by its very nature, its definition, nihilistic, because it has no meaning. It is devoid of meaning, what he's doing right now. Maybe I'm going too far, I don't know.
It's V-OK, you can't go too far.
I don't think he's a vampire though, right? I was just very powerfully affected by this chapter, and normally with Theon chapters, I'm more affected by the Theon part. But in this, I thought, this is one of the most close-up psychological portraits we've had of Roose, unless you buy Jock's idea that he's gaming Theon. Yeah. Any thoughts on Theon and where he is psychologically at this point? Maybe Abby, this idea that he's so scared he can't even be honest with Roose. He keeps on hiding in the right personality.
Yeah, I think this is the last chapter for Theon that's titled Reek, right?
I think so, yes.
So yeah, this is like kind of the climax of his, when he's the peak Reek, I guess. And then the rest is kind of the turning back into Theon. And so I think it's as they're getting closer to Winterfell and closer to, he's to acknowledge his truths. Because what is it? Lady Dustin, you know, is like, this is the guy, you know, this can't be the guy who killed these children. And he's like, I didn't do that. You know, Theon did that. I didn't. Theon is dead. So this is his, he's really peak Reek here because he's just so unable to come to terms with what he has done and been through at the same time. So yeah, I think his mentality is he's just reaching that point where it's like, you have to go all in before you can make a breakthrough, I guess. That's kind of what I'm trying to get at.
Interesting. So in your mind, do you think he kind of sees Roose's offer of, we'll clothe you. Does he see them as sincere, but feels he can't accept because it's going to piss off Ramsay and incur his wrath? Or does he even mistrust Roose at this point? Maybe it doesn't matter. Is he so burned that he can't even see a genuine offer of hospitality when it's offered?
I definitely, well, first of all, I don't think it's a genuine offer. I think it's he knows there's a it's a trick. Like what's happening is a trick. It, not in the way that Ramsay does tricks, but it is, he is trying, Roose is trying to manipulate Theon, and Theon, I think, knows that, but can't even if it were genuine, I don't think that he would be in a place where he could accept it as genuine.
Gosh.
And I think Theon's been like in this place where he's been broken down so much that I don't even know if he's thinking that far ahead or thinking it through that much. I think people who are that psychologically broken at a certain point just become obsessed with things that they know may benefit them. And he knows that one of the things that, Ramsay likes is to for him to stink and for him to keep these clothes on. He's not allowed to take these clothes off. So I think that he's just built an obsession with keeping these rags on and making sure that every single thing that he does is per Ramsay's liking, that I don't even know if he would be thinking that, Roose is trying to double cross him. I think that he's just so obsessed with one thing. I have to stay stinky. I have to keep these clothes on. Nobody can take these clothes off of me, no matter who would have been trying to offer him, new clothing. I just think that he would have still denied it. I don't know if he thinks that far ahead or if he's thinking that coherently.
I think those are all good points. Any further comments on Theon or Roose or anything in this chapter?
The thing that really struck me about it was Roose was that Theon, was sort of I took his panicking at that offer to be connected to, the fact that Ramsay has mutilated him so bad and apparently, either just castrated him or completely cut off its penis. Like, you sort of, you're sort, it's sort of cheating to bring that up, I guess, because, maybe you don't figure that out quite yet in this chapter, but that was reading it again, and that seemed like one of those things that's like that was like one of the first clues that you get to that, where it's like, he has this horror of taking his clothes off. So I think part of it is just connected to that as much as anything about the clothes. Like, he just doesn't want to be naked because of what's been done to him.
Yeah, there's the line in the chapter that says something like, he doesn't want anybody to see me, and it's like, and I think I italicized letters or something like that. So I definitely thought that was kind of like really depressing to read that, he doesn't want to take off any of his clothes just because of how disgusted he is with who he's become and what they've done to him.
At this, I don't know, do you guys remember the first time you read these books? Did you think this was going to work, the whole wedding to Fae Caria? Did you think, I don't know, what did you think of all this? Or is it so far back in the mist of time you've forgotten?
Well, I'm scum. So when I read this book, I actually knew what happened because I really, once I get into a character, I don't really care about spoilers. So I'll go and read their Wikipedia page to figure out like when they show up. And, I don't really care about spoilers that much. It depends on what the piece of media is. But yeah, I knew all the stuff that happened with Jane because I really liked Theon. So I just went all in. So I didn't have a thought really.
Yeah, it's one of the heaviest storylines in there. Anyone else? Any thoughts on how you felt when you were reading it? I think for me it was just, I don't really watch horror movies. I kind of read it almost with one eye shut. It was very painful, and it's amazing to me how even this many years later after originally reading it, it can still have such an impact. It really gets me more than it perhaps any other POV in this book, all this stuff.
Yeah, I think I mentioned it in the Skype chat, but I really like the way that George writes Theon's chapters after the Sack of Winterfell. I think these are some of like the darkest chapters that we get to experience with a character. And I think this is kind of like where, I don't know, I really like the writing. Like you said, it makes you feel icky and kind of creepy and kind of like looking over your shoulder while you're trying to read this chapter. It was really nice. I like the writing.
And rightly so, Ria. I mean, I think that's what George does. That's why, even though he's describing stuff, and some people, I guess, might argue it's gratuitous, but it's not, because he takes us to the feeling we should have, which is horrific. I just also wanted to say one thing, which is that I had to Google a lot of words in this chapter. Did anyone know what a falchion was? Falchion? Falchion? A brigandine? I mean, again, it's just artistry, as well as describing all these maggoty heads. He uses all this beautiful sort of medieval armory terminology that even if you don't Google it, it just puts you into that milieu. I love all that kind of stuff, but it felt like I hadn't done that for a while since Game of Thrones, at the first book. I was like, what the hell is a falchion? Falchion? I don't even know.
Yeah, I couldn't tell you how to pronounce it, but I actually didn't know what a falchion was. And I guess a brigandine could be made of oiled leather.
Indeed. All leather must be boiled. How did you know what a falchion was? I mean, maximum nerd points, dude, but.
Kinds of swords are just sort of the sort of thing I know. Like, I know what a broadsword
Awesome.
is, things like
Awesome.
that.
I mean, I knew what a broadsword was. I mean, basically, if it was in Robin Hood, I probably figured out what it was. But yeah, falchion to me seems.
Yeah, it's basically a giant cleaver, which really, fits Ramsay's character that he would carry that. Because it's, for one, it's kind of, it's good for somebody who's maybe not as trained as, somebody who'd grown up as the heir would be, as far as, he's not necessarily going to fight with a long sword the way somebody like John or Rob would.
But even that's a great bit of character detailing, right? For the guy with a chip on his shoulder, never quite acknowledged that he hasn't had that training with a great master of arms, and he is going to be blundering. This is not the guy who trained for the tourney. He is just basically a hacker. Yeah, even at his most grotesque, George is super logical in how a character's constructed, which makes it even more intriguing for me what his intentions are with Rhys.
I did write down that Lord, I just in my notes, I have Lord Snow equals John. So from what I can remember, I think people, it was they cut the guy's head off because he called Ramsay Lord Snow. So there's just more John Ramsay parallels where with when John gets called Lord Snow, the emphasis is on the fact that he is the bastard son of a lord. Whereas when Ramsay gets called Lord Snow, it's the emphasis is on the fact that he is a bastard. So I just think that
Oh,
was
that's really
pretty
clever.
interesting.
Yeah. So on that happy note, let's jump to the next chapter for today, which is Brienne 8 from Feast. Sorry, this takes place the day later on May 17th, and I believe it is Dan with the chapter summary.
George continues his series of people having fever dreams slash sick dreams, this time with Brienne, after the early notable ones with Jamie, or I'm sorry, with Jamie and with Ned and with oh crap, I'm forgetting the other one now. Oh, and Tyrion. Yeah, Tyrion after the Battle of Blackwater, where he's got that sort of series of chapters that he does, and he also it's also sort of a continuation of his Ned and Davos chapters where they're both imprisoned. So it really this one really reminds me of that. But so, in a lot of ways, in some ways kind of not that much happens for the first half of it, as Brienne gets taken, along by Jane Heddle, and Gendry is there, and she's basically getting treated so she can go see Lady Stoneheart. And she gets taken to a cave where she meets Thoros of Myr, or kind of what's left of Thoros of Myr, and gets a little explanation of the Brotherhood Without Banners that Lord Beric is gone now, and a grimmer shadow leads us in his place. And then when then she gets brought before Lady Stoneheart along with Pod and Sir Hyle, and tries to defend herself, but she may be a true knight, but she's not a true lawyer. And doesn't even do a very good job of defending herself. Not that I think it would have done her much good. And then we get the sort of reveal on camera of Lady Stoneheart and who exactly she is. And it's, appropriately horrifying as she's holding her throat back together and everything like that. And then Brienne gets given the choice at the end of kill Jaime Lannister or be hanged. And Brienne makes sort of the honorable choice first and says, no, I won't make that choice. But then when she's actually being hung, and I think maybe more importantly, Podrick is being hung, I don't think she cares that much about Heil Hunt, probably, but she finally screams out a word, and that's our chapter.
Da, da, da. Yeah, from one really horrific chapter into another, at least at the start, because you've ended the previous Brienne with one of the best images in the whole series, which is, the sword coming through the tongue and her thinking that it's the tongue, and then you finally find out what actually happened to her. But again, lots of really horrific, graphic, horrible imagery. I guess we should reveal to everyone what we think the word is, even though this is very well worn. Dan, what is the word?
The word was sword, and apparently Martin actually even confirmed that at a con back in 2012 or something, when he was asked about it. Or so says the So Spake Martin thing.
Yeah, and he didn't really even think it was a big deal. Like, he was just like, why is this like a, why are you guys obsessing about this? And it was like, ah. what does this set up then? Does this set up by implication that she now have to go and kill Sir Jaime? Is that what you think is all happening to Brienne?
You know, based on what we see later as far as Jaime going off with her, it might be something a little more complicated than that. But, you know, you sort of, you wonder what exactly she may have, you know, told him in the subsequent chapters. But yeah, I mean, that's got to be the basic part of it where, you know, that's the only way she can prove her loyalty to Cat, you know, to the Revenant of Catelyn Stark is killing Jaime Lannister. And in a lot of ways, I tend to doubt that even if she were to kill Jaime, just like Lady Stoneheart said, that would sort of wash out her crimes in the eyes of Lady Stoneheart. I don't think Lady Stoneheart works that way. I mean, Stannis doesn't even work that way, you know, and he's a little, he's, you know, fair and lenient compared to Lady Stoneheart.
The problem with Brienne is that she's a deeply honorable person, but she transfers her loyalties so permanently, but on such a whim. So she transfers it from Renly to Catelyn, and then apparently from Catelyn, which doesn't really make sense to me, and even after she thinks Cat's dead, to finding the daughters, and then, although I guess that is also partly for Jaime, and then now to Lady Stoneheart. I mean, at what point does an oath not become binding? I think Brienne has a real problem with taking oaths too seriously. I know we all love her for being honorable, but at some point there's a limit, right? I don't know.
Yeah, I mean, Brienne is very much the, you know, she's George's true knight. And, you know, what do knights do? They, you know, they go on quests where they probably are taking these oaths a lot too seriously. Like, you know, everything that Galahad goes through to get the Holy Grail, was that really worth it in a lot of the Arthurian stories? You know, so it's sort of the flip side, you know, like you were suggesting with her, or her, you know, sort of goodness and, you know, true heart, I guess, is that, you know, she almost, as a character, almost has to take these things too seriously. And, you know, to speak to your other point, I think she transfers her loyalty really quickly like that because she needs something or somebody to be loyal to. You know, that's sort of how she's built, in that, you know, her makeup as a knight and everything, you know, she has to be serving somebody or going on quests for somebody because, you know, I think because she's so unsure of herself a lot of the time, that, you know, being unsure of herself about being a woman who's trying to be a knight, if she was also, you know, basically thinking for herself on a meta level and not having somebody like Catelyn or Renly to serve, I think that would just be kind of too much and not really her thing.
So you think this is, do you all think this is her genuinely, honestly, when she says sword, thinking I will prove myself to Stoneheart and kill Jaime? Or do you think this is her, because there's another interpretation which is still motivated by honor, which is poor Podrick did nothing to get himself into this like you done. I don't think she gives a shit about Hal Hunt, so I'll say sword, and that just buys me time. I don't feel that I'm bound to an oath to a dead lady zombie woman who may or may not really be Kat, and I have feelings for Jaime, but I just need to get out of this to save Pod.
I think it's neither of those, in the sense that, because I hadn't even considered your second option at all. Like, I definitely think that, yeah, she wants to save Pod, but I don't think that was the motivating factor for saying sword. I also don't think that she believes that Jaime deserves to be put to the sword, deserves to be brought forth Lady Stoneheart to be killed. I don't know how she's going to solve the situation, but I think she's going to try to do, something's going to happen where she's going to try to prove Jaime's honor, or in some, you know, she's going to try to convince Stoneheart or something of Jaime's honor as a true knight, you know, for saving the Seven Kingdoms, you know, whatever, that kind of thing. Because the problem with her making so many oaths is she's been forced to realize that people aren't so black and white. There's not, this person is good, this person is bad. And so she's going to have to do something where she can prove Jaime's worth, but also she does need to acknowledge the crimes that he has done.
I mean, what happens when oaths conflict, when your obligation to Jaime conflicts with your obligation to Kat, and it's going to force her to think for herself? I'm hoping this is the start of a true awakening in Brienne, which is the kind of the move from being the kind of the more purely honorable into being a bit like Jamie, the more sort of conflicted, I have to do good things and sometimes I have to do bad things, and there's a wider purpose, kind of an interesting character going forward. I mean, I think she's really interesting now, but I think this is the trigger of an evolution which we haven't yet seen, which is so frustrating. And that's why I think some people were angry when George confirmed what the word was, but I think in a sense that misses the point, because you can know what the word is and you still don't know what her thinking is in saying it, and that will affect the choices she makes thereafter and the motivations, like which of the various options we've discussed will really affect your view of where she is as a character. So I love it. I think it's the perfect cliffhanger, even though we know what the word is, because we still don't know why and wherefore.
The first time I read this, when I saw Brienne come back in Jamie's chapter, because I understood that she, in her chapter, she was being hung and she said a word. I didn't know if they would have necessarily cut her down immediately. So when I saw her in Jamie's chapter and she seemed like a little bit more of a grim character to me, I thought, I didn't know if she actually did die and then they brought her back and she lost a part of herself. And so her going to get Jamie was a little bit more kind of just like following Stoneheart. Like I know that's a little tinfoily. Most people, you know, would, yeah, but that's just me. Of course, I have to say it. But it just, the way that I read her in that Jamie chapter when she comes back, it just doesn't seem like he doesn't see her with like a light in her eyes. He sees her, I feel like, a little bit more of a darker person, or at least that's the way I read it.
Which I think is also valid, right?
Yeah, so even if she didn't die and get brought back, I just think that the light in her is missing a little bit when she goes to get Jamie. I definitely don't think that she's doing it willingly, or, you know, that she has any thoughts of actually killing him.
Dan, which way do you lean?
Well, I was going to say I thought her loyalty had been transferred to basically to Podrick and to Jamie to a lesser extent, but maybe even more to Podrick. Like, I was thinking back to the scene in the earlier chapter where she buries Nimble Dick and sort of, you know, she says like, oh, I forgot how to trust people. And I thought maybe that was kind of, you know, a clue that she was, you know, going to trust people and see people like, you know, that her loyalty should be to, you know, should be to Podrick and people like that that she cares about. But what Abby said really kind of was persuasive. So I might have to agree with her.
Yeah. I love that though. I love the idea that, yeah, like I said, a decade later, you can still get new ideas about a chapter that change your perspective.
Yeah, good books. I think these books are good.
And these chapters are awesome too. They're so rich and they are ambiguous.
The first, so I read this chapter and then afterwards I was cleaning the house and I was listening to a playlist, and Badlands by Bruce Springsteen came on, and I immediately thought that Badlands by Bruce Springsteen should be the Brotherhood Without Banners theme song, like, yes. 100%. And then reading the lyrics, I'm like, holy shit, it really is like perfect. It fits perfect. Well, and there's even that, there's like a line in it that says like, for the ones who had a notion deep inside that it ain't no sin to be glad that you're alive. Like, bam, that is the Brotherhood Without Banners. Like, they're just they're the small folk who, you know, are just alive, and that is their sin.
I'm caught in a crossfire that I don't understand.
Mm-hmm. It's perfect.
Rich man wanna be king, Tywin Lannister.
Yeah, and a king ain't satisfied until he rules everything.
Let the broken heart stand as the price you gotta pay. Such a beautiful lyric. Fucking love me some Bruce Springsteen. Okay.
His old music videos, he is a man to look at too. Oh my god.
he's aging really well. Still looks fine.
Fantastic. I'm going to say that the Brotherhood started at Badlands, but they ended up more in something like Decoration Day by the Drive-By Truckers. Maybe we won't go into those lyrics too much, but just suffice to say, it's a song about how revenge sucks.
Okay, now I have to, I need to see the lyrics now.
I think I'm going to see the Drive-By Truckers next month.
Oh, I'm jealous as hell. They're not coming to Michigan this year.
Yeah, I'm going to Toronto, and they're supposed to be playing at some bar that my family wants to go to, so I'll let you know how I feel. They represent the Brotherhood fight. We for sure end up going.
they won't play that song, actually, because that guy's no longer in the band. But,
well, this is some dark cast shit. And I have a mind to roll a stone on his grave. I felt very, very, very pissed off. I remember distinctly reading this when it came out and knowing this was the last Brienne chapter. Or at that point, we knew that it was split between Feast and Dance. We didn't necessarily... We ended up getting more chapters of some people in Dance, but I'm not sure we knew that was going to be the case. So thinking this was the last chapter, that this is how George was going to play me, I was fracking unamused. Because it just felt like she did nothing for like most of the book. Like, this is Brienne 8. And then the final chapter was so awesome. Or the final two chapters were so awesome of her arc. And then that's it. And it was... Yeah, I was unamused, put it that way. Okay, so let's move on to Cersei 10 from Feast. This is the same chapter. Sorry, this takes place on the same day, and it's the sequential chapter. And in the absence of Gaydon, who I think has fallen by the wayside given the rescheduling of this recording, you've got Queen James gallantly stepping in.
All right, so since the summary is pretty long, I think I might just do like a Matt Varley style, just gonna freaking wing it here.
Awesome.
So the chapter opens up with Cersei holding court, and she publicly shades Margaery in front of everybody, kind of making sure that the crimes are out there and making sure that everybody knows about them. And then when she's walking away, she's all freaking happy with herself, knowing that she slandered Margaery's name. After that, she gets Tommen to sign some blank warrants, pretty much arresting all the people that she wants to. And it's she's summoning Sir Osfrid so he can go arrest Sir Talid, the Blue Bard, Hugh Clifton, Mark Mullendore, and the Redwane twins. But she wants to make sure that the Redwane twins... are found innocent. After that, they get summoned to the Great Sept of Baelor, where Cersei goes to talk to Margaery, and Tyanna Meriwether goes to talk to Margaery's cousins. She's talking to Margaery, and she's being real freaking shady, and Margaery isn't quite picking up on it in the beginning, until Cersei mentions the whole thing about how a knight of the Kingsguard would have to defend her in a trial by combat, and she knows that Sir Loras is wounded, and everybody else is gone, and Jaime only has one hand, and so she would be left with two of the shittiest Kingsguard members. So she wants to send for her brother, Garland the Gallant, but Cersei says that that cannot be done. So Margaery calls her a vile, scheming, evil bitch, which is very appropriate in the context. After that, Cersei goes to talk to the High Sparrow. She gets brought deep into the Visenya's High Hill. And as they're talking, Cersei thinks that she's playing everything until she finds that they have Osmi Kettle Black hanging by his arms and being whipped. That is where one of the greatest lines of the book happens, when he says that he fucked that one there, meaning that he never slept with Margaery, he slept with Cersei. At that, Cersei freaking books it out of there, and she's trying to run through people. She scratches an old lady in the face, just making her way through until she gets captured, brought into a cell. 2 days later, Qyburn comes to visit her and basically tells her that within the past 2 days since she fell, Harris Swift and Pycelle are running the realm. The Meriwethers have fled to Long Table, and Sir Kevin is going to take up the regency. They've sent for him, and he should be coming. All the while, Orane Waters did take his Drummonds to God knows where. They think he's going to go be a pirate. Mace Tyrell and Randall Tarly are marching towards King's Landing. This is when Cersei sends the letter to Jaime, which is, come at once, help me, save me. I need you as I have never needed you before. I love you, I love you, I love you. Come at once. And that's the end of the chapter. I did think that it was, I didn't know why Qyburn brought up why to say I love you thrice, but I think that that is important. But other than that, yeah, that's the chapter.
Why do you think it's important? Brilliant summary, by the way, especially winging it.
Yeah, just wing it. I don't know, because the only reason that it sticks out to me is because Qyburn says, I love you thrice, and she says yes. But other than that, I can't figure out why that would be important, or if there's any history with her and Jaime that saying I love you three times means something. I just thought that it may have some sort of importance later. But we do know that when Jaime gets this letter, he just, you know, throws it in a fire.
Thoughts on this chapter, boys and girls? Apart from the obvious, it's so excruciating watching Cersei thinking she's got the upper hand against Margaery and failing to see that she's about to fall for exactly the same trap from the High Septon. It's just, as much as I don't often like her, I was genuinely tense in the first half of this chapter, thinking she just has no idea. She's congratulating herself, and oh, it's gonna end so badly.
Well, and the way you read it on a reread is so different than you do the first time, because the first time I got to this chapter, it hadn't happened yet in the show or anything. I read the books before season 4 came out, so I just remember reading it and thinking, like, is she actually going to get away with this? What's going to happen? And then getting the satisfaction of her, you know, getting captured and everything, I loved it. And then the second time I read it, I felt a little bad for her. So I don't know if it's just the difference in a reread versus your first time.
But even on the first time, I feel George does that to me again and again. So I like hated Theon. I thought he was just a shit. And then you're like, oh, it's going to be great seeing him punished by Ramsay. And then it's just like, oh no, I don't want him punished this much. That was horrible. And the same with Cersei. It's like, oh, she's just been an absolute menace. I'm so pleased the High Septon's just going to knock her arrogance. And it's like, oh no, 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 this is too much. I feel that George just takes us to this brink of punishment and where we should feel this schadenfreude because he's such a good character writer. He just forces us to take the new perspective. And it's amazing how knowing that you're probably right does therefore reflect on how I read the first half of this chapter, which is just, it's almost unreadable because I'm so in pain for Cersei, because as much as she is and does despicable things, I think there's so much in her childhood and her position as a woman that for me partially excuses it. And I know I probably give her an easy ride, but oh, it's so horrible. It's like watching someone you know just walk into a mistake and there's nothing you can do to stop them.
Mostly I was actually paying attention to Marjorie, because the first time I read this, I thought I had Marjorie, like this Cersei arc, I guess. I thought that I had Marjorie figured out as pretty conniving, scheming, you know, not like scheming, but in the know, like playing Cersei, you know, trying to do all the, like, pit Cersei against Tommen, you know, that kind of stuff, or pit herself, turn Tommen against Cersei, sorry. But then rereading this, Marjorie seems, I don't know, maybe she's faking it, but she seems so naive and innocent and truly trying to get Cersei to help her and truly thinks that Cersei can do something until she, I can't remember the line, but until Cersei says some line, then she kind of clicks in her brain that Cersei has been out to get her this whole time. I don't know. I don't know why I didn't pick up on that the first time I read this.
Cersei's such a larger-than-life character. She does sometimes block out the sun, and you forget to analyze what's going on with the other characters. I have to say, I reread this chapter totally wrapped up in Cersei and not paying much attention to Margaery, which she deserves, right? Because she is young and clever and in many ways playing the same hand as Cersei much better. The only vibes I really got from reading this of Margaery was, God, this is so Anne Boleyn, who probably did have affairs, didn't have as many as she was accused of, and was accused of being a witch and a whore and blah, 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 and shut up and eventually killed. And yeah, it's very clear where George is getting his inspiration from here. Sorry, James.
I was just going to say, I think Margaery and Cersei are similar in the sense that it seems they've both been raised very, you know, privileged and they've had everything. And even when Cersei gets thrown into her cell, when she's put in rags, you know, she rips up the rags and she throws the water and she breaks her chamber pot. And then she's stuck there shivering and peeing in a corner without anything to drink. I think that both her and Margaery are the same, that they've never had to struggle. If they broke their chamber pot, someone was going to come in 5 minutes later with another chamber pot. And so now to just be left completely without and to have to do demoralizing things like, you know, urinate in a corner of a 5x5 cell, I think it's, you know, it's breaking them down so much faster than it would break down anyone else. Within 2 days, it seems like Cersei's already just like a shell of the person that she was before. And the same thing, I don't think Margaery was in there very long before Cersei went to go visit her, and she was already just this matted looking creature. I think it's a lot easier for the Faith to break them down than it would be anybody else. You know, they're not in a dungeon getting whipped. They're you know, just being left in a room by themselves, and that's torture enough for these privileged people.
I'm not sure I think Margaery is actually getting broken down there. Like Abby was saying, like her, when you read her in this chapter, it's, at least to me, it was hard to interpret exactly how much was her sort of going along with Cersei and how much was her actually understanding what Cersei was all about all along. And then, you know, when she finally calls her a bitch, she's just gotten to the point where she realizes she can't get anything out of her, so she's just going to be honest. But like I, you know, maybe the show portrayal of Marjorie sort of bleeds over a little bit, but even in her previous appearances in the book, she seems like somebody who's just, you know, made of a little bit sterner stuff than Cersei. So I would think that she would actually last longer under the Faith's torture than Cersei is.
You definitely start to see some sort of cracks in Marjorie, because there's you can see the cracks in her facade of being the friend of the people, you know, looking out for the little guy. I'm sure she is genuine in some parts, but a lot of it is an act. But I don't know about the stuff with Cersei, if that was an act or not, or if she just genuinely was trying to befriend Cersei.
I just think she was kind of probably trying to reach out for any hand that may help her at that point. That's why I think, you know, and before Cersei said the thing about, you know, it would have to be a sworn brother of the Kingsguard to defend her. Before she said that, you know, she was trying to at least grasp at this straw that Cersei was handing out. It seemed, and then once she realized that Cersei wasn't going to help her at all, then, you know, she chided her and said, well, you're an evil scheming bitch or whatever. I don't know if she was necessarily trying to befriend Cersei or just trying to get help from anyone that was in the room at that point, because I'd imagine she hasn't had very many visitors or anything.
Oh, no, I was talking about previous, before this. This, I think she's just grasping at anything, but I was talking about until this scene, I didn't know. I figured it was the entire Cersei-Marjorie interactions up until this scene, so throughout the entire series. It seemed like Marjorie is actually very genuine in her attempts to reach out to Cersei because of this scene, like, makes me look back on all the previous interactions they've had where it kind of came across as snarky and a little condescending. But now
I'm kind of with you, actually, Abby, and I think that in a sense, you know, Marjorie can both be a cynical power player but also want to genuinely befriend Cersei or anyone, because part of the way in which she exercises power is through warmth and is through trying to make connections and be popular. She tries to do it through love rather than fear, to use the cliche. So I think there's probably many layers to how she acts towards Cersei at the various points.
I understand now what you were saying, Abby, before. And yeah, I definitely think Marjorie is very good in the art of shade. I think, you know, showing a smile while also being a backhanded bitch is a skill to have. And I think that she definitely has mastered that skill, at least upon a reread. For me, reading her lines and her interactions with Cersei a second time definitely takes some of, at least for me, it takes some of the genuineness out of Marjorie and just makes her seem a little bit more of a player rather than just a nice girl who's trying to befriend her boy king and his mom.
The main reaction I had to this chapter was just like, you know, the sort, like you were talking about before, like it's just like watching cringe comedy. It's like, you know, the dinner party episode of the U.S. Office or something, where Cersei's just going along thinking like, oh, I got this, I'm smarter than everybody. And you just know, because you've read it before, that she's really, really not. And she really, 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 really doesn't. And she's just heading for a fall. So it was, you know, very much like, you know, reading it through, like, you know, you almost want to like read it through, you know, read it through your fingers or something. Like you're watching a horror movie. It's just so cringeworthy. You know, just kind of the Cersei, especially the parts where she's congratulating herself, and it's just like,
I know.
Oh my God.
Oh, it's just appalling.
she actually thinks this is working and she's winning.
I was literally just thinking to myself, if in life you ever think you're winning, just check yourself, because you probably aren't.
There's an Artemis Fowl quote similar to that sort of sentiment, in which it's, if you're ever confident you're wrong, there is something you've missed.
That's a great quote. Have we ever done a VOC on Artemis Fowl? And if not, no, not, why not? Anything else on this amazing and brilliant chapter?
Where do we think Irene Waters is taking the Drummonds? Do we see him later? I don't recall.
There's a mention of something, but I won't say what it is because it's from one of the Winds chapters.
Oh, okay. Maybe in the after show.
Oh, okay. Yeah, definitely. Enlighten me, please.
We will do that, listeners, in the after show, along with some Game of Thrones chats for those who are interested on how that may influence or be influenced by these chapters. But anything else just on the contents of the book?
I love Cersei chapters because I love her POV so much, and I just marked this one quote that I thought was just the epitome of Cersei chapters. It's not very profound, but when she's just talking about,
the proceedings after she gets Tommen to sign all that stuff. She goes, by the time the sun went down that day, all of the accused traitors were in custody. And she's already thinking them of traitors. She's already convinced herself that it's true. And I just really like that. I love Cersei chapters because she just convinces herself. She starts off being like, this is fake, but then just immediately she's one of those people where she tells herself it's true. She automatically believes in her own lies. And I love that.
She has a little bit of that kind of what I say is true by virtue of the fact that I am the queen kind of thing. You know, because I said it, it is true because I said it and I am who I am. Pycelle, what a treacherous little shit he turned out to be.
I don't understand why he wasn't also imprisoned, because he, in the like proceedings or whatever, they bring about how he was a complicit in supplying Margaery with moon tea, and one of the cousins is under... is standing trial because she, even though didn't do anything, she was complicit in it. And so I just don't understand why Pycelle also, is it just general misogyny, or is it because he's a member of the, like, the Maesters, or what the exact reasoning behind
that is? Well, why would the High Septon have any love for the Maesters, right? Unless the High Septon realizes that he needs a few bureaucrats just to run shit while he's doing his religious war. I don't know. I mean, similarly, you know, they've called for Sir Kevin to be the regent. But don't they think Sir Kevin will just come with a bunch of troops and get Cersei out? Or do they just rely on the fact that Kevin hates Cersei too much? But surely, you know, family honor, house first kind of stuff. The whole thing seems a bit fishy, really.
Yeah, going back to the moon tea with Pycelle, I think it's similar to when Sandor Clegane killed the butcher boy, where it's like he's a servant of the queen, and, you know, he was doing something that the queen told him to do rather than, you know, a friend of the queen covering up for her. He, you know, he was pretty much doing his job, similar to Sandor couldn't be considered a murderer of that boy because he was ordered to do it for the king. You know, he didn't willingly go make moon tea, he was ordered to. So I think there's a difference between his, you know, not saying anything about it and Margaery's cousins.
I think it's basically pure politics on the part of the High Sparrow, where he's, you know, he doesn't want to antagonize the Maesters by imprisoning the Grand Maester, more so than, you know, kind of considering the facts of the case or anything. And I mean, I don't believe there's mention of this anywhere, but maybe there's sort of a tradition of like maesterly, like maester client privilege or something, where you don't have to, you know, you're supposed to be able to go to the maester for whatever, and he doesn't blab about it. Although in Fire and Blood, they definitely imprison a few Grand Maesters, so it's certainly been done before. But I think the High Sparrow is just, you know, not going to try to make any more enemies than he has to as far as imprisoning maesters. So, you know, I just don't think it's about what Pycelle did or didn't do. I think it's about the politics of the situation as far as the High Sparrow thinks.
Yeah, I think you're probably right. I just want to point out that when I originally read this book, and there was a long wait for Dance, we had ended this universe, this book, as far as we knew it existed, with fucking Sahara Swift in charge, who we didn't even know who he was. That was a profoundly frustrating position to be in. It's all y'all bitching about T-Wow, and you never had a wait before? That was a wait. That was a wait. anything else on this lovely chapter?
I did want to mention something you mentioned before about Sir Kevin. Then bring him. Is it public knowledge that him and Cersei are kind of at odds, or shouldn't it be? I thought that was more like behind closed doors, that people wouldn't really know that they're not getting along, and that she offered him the job of being the Hand, and he refused and everything. Or would that be public knowledge?
I'm just assuming there are so many spies around, people know, but maybe they don't.
Yeah, because then I would agree with you with saying, like, then why would they bring in, you know, like, if it seems like people are trying to get Cersei out of power, then, yeah, why would you bring in her uncle, who you would imagine would be completely loyal to his niece, unless it was public knowledge that, you know, that they were at odds. Which, obviously, when he comes, he's not Team Cersei anyways.
Which makes me think they knew that. He's the Lannister we can deal with. Let's at least have a male, white male Lannister that we can deal with, you know? Because basically that's what we end up with, right? Margaery and Cersei under lock and key. And the boys are back in charge. The B-listers have their day. Ugh.
See how well the action gets when the men get in charge?
I just feel that as much as I wanted Cersei to get her comeuppance, I didn't want these people to be in charge. It's kind of like, ugh. I don't know. And also, like, look at the names in this final chapter. Okay, Varys, major player. Pycelle, major player. But Harris Swift, Auron Waters, these aren't people that fundamentally speak to me. I mean, I don't care.
I think on my first podcast, I mentioned that Cersei's picking of her small council was like me picking fantasy football players. Like, she had no idea what she was picking or who she was picking them for, or even what the position that she was picking them for was supposed to do. She was just kind of like, hot guy, you do this, you know, coffee guy, you go over there. And it just didn't seem like she really had much of a, there was no method to her madness when she was picking it. And now this is what we're left with.
That is the ultimate tagline for Cersei, isn't it? No method to her madness. It just sums up the whole of Feast, basically, for Cersei.
Oh. I mean, 10 chapters. 10 chapters worth of that.
Poor girl. But they are some... I think, honestly, she's the best POV in Feast. It's the most juicy, for sure. Okie dokie. Anything else on these chapters? These chapters? Anything else from anyone else?
Oh, just earlier on the Brienne chapter, I forgot to mention that I now... I really hate Lem Lemoncloak after reading that chapter. Like, I'd forgotten what a shithead he is. And I'm going to say that... I believe his cloak is actually made out of piss.
He is made out of piss. Oakley dokley. Well, on that note, I think we can end the main part of this discussion. So my name's Bina 007. I want to also thank Queen James, Stacey Mormont, Witless Chum, Munro Jot for joining. Thanks, Guy.
You're welcome.
Thank you, Bina.
Thanks for hosting.
No problem. And I want to let the listeners know that the next episode, 88, is going to be hosted by Casey, Blue Eyed Queen, and it's going to cover Jamie 7 and Sam 5 from Feast, which is the last Sam chapter in Feast. It's the last Jamie chapter in Feast, although we do get a Jamie chapter in Dance, and Arya 1 from Dance, the blind girl, which is an awesome chapter. So, yeah, we're rapidly approaching the end of Feast. In fact, that is the final episode that we'll have Feast chapters in. So it feels like the reread is progressing. You know, slowly but surely we're getting towards the end. You guys should all stay tuned to the after show if you want to hear some Game of Thrones and Tewell stuff. In the meantime, I want to let you know that as well as following us on Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, iTunes, WordPress, Grindr, Tinder, by searching for VOK Podcast or Vassals of Kingsgrave, we're now also on Spotify. Thanks to Valkyrist, aka Duncan on the forums, who's finally got us on there. And to get involved, please search for a podcast of Ice and Fire and join the forums. So does anyone have any cool forthcoming episodes that they want to pimp out while we're here?
I think that we might be doing a D&D podcast. I don't know. There's talk of recording it, so that might be something that's happening.
Well, that would be awesome. I hope it happens. Similarly, there's chat about doing a HBO Chernobyl podcast and a Amazon Good Omens podcast, both of which were very cool TV shows. And hopefully something on Pose with Queen James in the near future.
Yes.
Yes.
Yes, I was going to say we have to do our Pose podcast.
We do. Dan, have you got anything else coming up?
I don't think so. I have not signed up for anything, but, you know, I'm planning to be around VOK much more this year. That's sort of my May resolution.
Oh, I'm really pleased. I love how the VOK community goes through seasons. So as, say, for example, Valkyris decides to drop out for a few months to submit his PhD, then other people come back into the forums and participate, and then it just feels like it's beautifully ebbing and flowing with different people coming in and out, and that's just lovely. Okay, so listeners, as I said, stay tuned to the after show if you would like some Game of Thrones and TWOW chat. Bye!
Bye! Did you guys see he posted something about how he wants to have T-WoW out by mid-2020 or something like that?
Yes, I did.
Did that give you any hope at all? Because it gave me hope.
Didn't he say last year he wanted it out by the end of 2019?
I don't remember what he said exactly the last year, but this was much more definite, where it was, you know, where he was saying, you know, I'm going to this, I don't remember if it was Worldcon or one of the conventions that he always goes to, and, you know, he said something like, you know, if I haven't delivered the Winds of Winter by the time this comes, you know, you can lock me up. Or something like that. So that's what people are. But that's what he actually said. So
he hasn't said things like that.
It's
recently.
More sort of like optimistic and specific than anything he said in a long time.
I'm optimistic. I think we're definitely going to get T-WoW streams. I wonder about, and whether it comes in 2020, 2021. It's cool. I've waited this long. And actually, you know, reading these three chapters, two from Feast, but you know, one from Fairly Deep Into Dance, which is a book a lot of people slam. I mean, they're beautifully written. Just at the kind of the sentence level, at the word choice, at the metaphor level, let alone at the plot arc level and the character development, it kind of re-inspires me with my love of George. And, you know, I'll wait. I get more depressed for a Dream than I do for T-WoW. I think T-WoW's kind of on its way. It's probably in the kind of nearly first draft done or polishing stage, somewhere in between those. But Dreams? I don't know if we're getting Dreams.
Yeah, and also there's the whole thing of, is he really going to finish this thing in 7 books? You know, because like his wife has like openly said that she doesn't think he can finish it in 7 books, and she knows him pretty well and knows more about it than we do.
I just think people have a lot of expectations for what's going to be in Winds, because it sounds like people think basically everything that's going to happen in the last books are going to be in Winds, and people are going to be really disappointed when there's still plot holes or like loose threads. And so
I mean, I get what you're saying, Abby. I think you're right. I think there will be stuff that obviously has to hang over to Dream, but I think there are characters and plot arcs and battles that get done early on in Winds, maybe in stuff that was actually written for Dance, and then we move back to Westeros pretty quickly, and therefore you don't need as many POVs, and you can, you know, the bringing everything together should make it more expeditious, one hopes. And I'm hoping he's got a lot of his world-building kind of, let's have Brienne just wander around aimlessly kind of stuff out of his system with Fire and Blood in some of those books. So I don't know, maybe getting the world building stuff out and some of the history out separately makes the books now leaner, and they can be a bit more Tolkien's Lord of the Rings, where they hint at stuff that happened in the past but don't need to go into it and into it, because that's been done separately.
Well, the Winds sample chapters are fantastic.
Yeah, exactly. He hasn't brought out a sample chapter in quite a while though.
Well, he said he wasn't going to do that anymore, because didn't he already release like 12% of the book, or like a tenth of the book or something?
Oh, really?
Yeah. It's like much more than he released before Dance came out.
Yeah.
If I remember right.
Yeah.
Although, not that I was around for all the Dance
books. Yeah. Same, but I've heard the stories that he made some, not a blog post about in like 2013 or something, where he's like, I can't release it anymore because this is the book. He's basically giving out the book.
Yeah, I'm sure the publishers
went. I love your George impression.
I mean,
yeah.
That's my any person.
I can't really say anymore. So.
I mean, there's got to be huge kind of pressure from the publishers to say, get it out this year. I mean, you've got to get out within 12 months of the end of GOT, otherwise the sort of popularity just starts to wane.
Yeah, but how do you pressure somebody who's independently wealthy?
Well, quite. Reshape your legacy. I mean, maybe this will be inspiring to him now, just seeing GOT go down in flames for the ending. I mean, he looked really depressed when he thought someone else was going to tell his ending. But now he knows how much the fans hated it. It's like, right, fuck this shit. Let me... The decks are now cleared. I can write the ending that I wanted, knowing full well that I don't have to match up to anything they did. It's so hated, I can just do my thing.
It's time to break his kneecaps. That's how you pressure him.
Physical violence.
Well, like Kathy Bates and Mercy him.
Exactly.
Pass around the falchions. Let's go to Texas. Well, on that murderous note.
Yeah, I don't actually have a falchion. I just know what they are. I'm sure, have a tomahawk though.
I'm sure we can get falchions. I mean, isn't that what the dark web is for? I've never been on the dark web. I don't even have a VPN. I'm basically very basic when it comes to the internet. But anyway.
I don't know, man. Nowadays, you can find anything on Amazon. Just Amazon it. Look for it on Prime.
Do you really?
Yeah, this is definitely the kind of... Yeah, you could totally... You go to somewhere like some medieval fun land on vacation. You could send this, buy something like this, send it home. You know, you could do it. Mm-hmm. I just looked up what it is. We were talking about this like an hour ago and I still didn't know what it was.
Okay, I'm looking up Falchion now on Amazon UK. Falchion knife.
Old French. Oh, it's Falchion, by the way.
Falchion.
Or Falchion. Maybe that's the old French.
I'm being offered some very flashy Japanese knives.
Wait, shoot. Okay. Oh, I can never make this sound. Falchion. Sorry. Trying to read the transcription. I didn't do very well in phonetics, okay?
There are some very nice replica knives, but there are not actual Falchions. That's probably a good thing. Cool, okay, so we can quickly cover off the T-Whirl thing. So listeners, if you're not doing T-Whirl spoiler chapters, you need to tune out now. So Dan, do you want to explain the Auron Waters reference?
Yeah, in one of the Arien chapters that we've gotten so far, I just pulled it up on a wiki of Ice and Fire, and they say, you know, according to Velina Toland, a new pirate king has set up at Torturer's Deep in the Stepstones. Apparently there's a place called Torturer's Deep in the Stepstones. And he's styling himself the Lord of Waters. He commands three-decked warships. Whoever wrote this entry in the Wiki of Ice and Fire happily says, some readers have theorized this to be Orion Waters, probably because it's obviously Orion Waters.
I was going to say, it's pretty obvious the way that the description that we just got. He's got three warships. He's the Lord of Waters. He went to the Stepstones.
Yeah, I mean, that's not a particularly deep cut theory, is it?
I know. I wouldn't be shocked if when we get the actual book, that was maybe obscured a little bit more, you know, or George muddied that up if he was actually trying to make it a, you know, if, you know, I doubt he's trying to make much of a mystery of, you know, what Orion Waters is up to, because as you said earlier, I don't think George cares that much about Orion Waters or expects us to.
Exactly. But then that does bring me back to my earlier point, which is, why should I care so much about the betrayal of Cersei by Auron Waters when it's clear that neither we nor George should really give a shit about him, otherwise he would have mentioned him earlier. Same with Harris Swift and all these other yahoos. I mean, like, you know, I just can't get too excited about that.
It's sort of ironic because Orion Waters and Harry Swift and these characters are only sort of important or interesting in that they reflect what an idiot Cersei is being by putting them in their positions. But that's also sort of how Cersei sees almost the entire human race, as irrelevant other than how she interacts with them or how she can get something from them or something like that, you know, with the possible exceptions of Jaime and Tommen and Joffrey and maybe Myrcella? Hard to say. But I don't know. I just had that thought and I thought it was amusing.
Mm. Yeah. Do you think the I love you, I love you, I love you is in reference to their three children?
Okay. That makes sense because, like I said, I think it's significant, but I couldn't figure out why. But yeah,
could
I
it
guess
be the... hinting at a pregnancy? I mean, they have bumped uglies since he got back famously.
Would that be for like three living children, I guess? Because then wouldn't there be a fourth?
No, but just like mentioning kids and then, I don't know.
Oh,
I'm just
yeah.
making this shit up. What do I know?
Yeah. Well, I mean, I think being the fact that they did sleep together since he got back, you know, there is the possibility that she may be pregnant. But we also know Cersei's been sleeping with other people, too. Mm-hmm. And who's to say that it would be Jaime's if she was pregnant and it wouldn't be a kettle black or something come out with like black hair?
Yeah, the good
moon boys.
We'll know from the hair color.
Or moon boys, exactly. For moon boys, for all I know, you know.
Jesus. Okie dokie. If anyone was doing T-Web preview chapters but not doing Game of Thrones, now is your time to dial off because we are now going to talk Game of Thrones. Game of Thrones coming up. You had your chance. Don't blame us. Hang up. Put the podcast down. Okay, so when I was reading the Cersei chapter, there is one line in, I can't remember whether it's in the letter or in her inner monologue, where she says, we came into this, you know, she's getting very nihilistic about how, you know, all of this is turning to ashes and her plans are turning to dust. And she said she's going to ask Jaime to come back and says, as we came into the world together, so we will leave it together, even to death. And I thought, for those of us who've watched the show, that is pretty much what happens, right? That whether or not in the context of the book, he's tossed the letter into the fire, do you still think it's possible that he will come back to defend her, just as in the show, the pull of Cersei has proved too much, even after his Brienne redemption arc? It just felt very foreshadowing-y for the final episode of Game of Thrones. Well, the penultimate episode of Game of Thrones, I guess.
Oh, I think the burning of the letter was kind of like the, I'm trying to use a metaphor, can't think of one or whatever, but it kind of put the final nail in the coffin, that's what I'm trying to say. And Jaime's relationship with Cersei as far as how much how loyal he is to her. I think, honestly, in the show, they just did that because, I know that people say, like, oh, Jaime's not on a redemption arc or whatever, so it makes sense that he went back to her. But I just feel like George is not going to go to this place where he's like, psych, Jaime, everything that Jaime learned along the way is meaningless and pointless, and you're all jokes for believing that. Like, I don't know, maybe Brienne isn't going to factor into Jaime's lack of loyal, newfound lack of loyalty to Cersei, but I think that he's finally being able to be his own person, and the burning of the letter is really important to that. And so I do not think that was a really long way to say, no, I do not think that he's going to go back to Cersei.
Yeah, I agree. I'm not happy with the way that the show portrayed their ending. I hold on to this idea that Cersei's going to die by the Voluncar. And I mean, it's something that it's one of like the first theories that I really got into, that I am 100% believing that Jaime is going to end up killing Cersei one way or another. So I think that they will definitely cross paths again by the end of the story, but I don't think it's going to be in a way that Jaime is going to go back to Cersei in a loving way. At least that's my hope. The only other thing that I think, and it was more of a show theory than a book theory, which obviously didn't work out anyways, but I want Jaime to die somehow valiantly or whatever, and then have Arya find his body, take his face, and kill Cersei as Jaime. And then Cersei wouldn't know that it's not Jaime until she realizes that he has two hands.
That
and
would
he's
be
strangling
amazing.
Her. That's like I've had this idea that it's going to happen, and then the show didn't do it, and I was so upset about it because I told literally everyone that I knew that theory was going to happen, and it didn't.
Well, that theory was awesome. That's what should have happened. Because, you know, there was so much build up to her being an assassin. And in the end, it just got used on the phrase. It didn't even... Okay, she calls the Night King, but not with her assassin kind of stylings. And it, yeah, the whole thing was
right.
Just in there.
Did you guys see all those, the We Forgot That memes of, I think it was Benioff. In one of the after shows, he said something about, oh, Danny kind of forgot that Euron had a fleet of ships, and so they just kept inserting different words in that in that style. And it was like, yeah, we kind of forgot that we spent four seasons building Arya up as a faceless man assassin to never use her.
Yeah, I posted that video in the show chat. It was like, it was those. He's like, yeah, it was a. Sitting next to, like, I was watching the season finale and sitting next to Benioff, and we spent 5 seconds scrolling on Reddit and found the first theory and decided to use that one.
Oh, Jesus Christ. I mean, you might have thought that maybe George did tell them that Bran ends up on the throne. I don't fucking know. But maybe if you knew that, and maybe if you knew that from the start, maybe you should have just made more of an effort to make Bran seem more interesting.
You maybe not cut him out for an entire season 5, you know, that you might not do that to the person that you're going to put on the throne at the end.
It's just the triumph of, like, you know, just like this Aristo emo kid who basically does fuck all and inherits the throne anyway.
Am I wrong in thinking that Bran shouldn't be able to leave the North, right? I mean, isn't he kind of like becoming Tree Bran? So how are they going to extract him from the tree and then take himself? I just don't understand.
I don't understand either. It makes my brain hurt. So the idea that I don't think this is what George is going to end it with. Maybe he's screwing with them. I don't know, but maybe it is. And I just know that if George makes it end like this, it'll be for some reason like King's Landing has been sacked by dragons and now Winterfell is the capital, or I don't know. I don't think it's going to be this.
Right. It definitely has to be much more complex than what they left us with.
Well, quite indeed.
Yeah, because I mean, it was just it was a very rough ending.
Anyway,
I've seen several lists of things that say like Game of Thrones is the number one worst finale in TV history.
Well, that's not true because people still bitch about Lost, right? I mean, I never watched Lost, but apparently people are still traumatized about that.
For me, the worst was True Blood. True Blood was the worst ending ever.
Oh, I didn't watch True Blood after about season four. It just became so bad.
It was horrible.
Yeah, when there was like a fairy blaster fight, that's where I fell out of True Blood.
Well, and if you read the books, you would have like, if I don't know, in the Sookie Stackhouse Chronicles or whatever it was, I read all those books and then watching like these fairies fight with light and stuff like that, it was just insane.
Yeah, I think I also bugged out after about four or five of the books too. But anyway, let's not turn this into Game of Thrones dirge because we have voluminous podcasts that do that.
Well, I will just throw in something for the Jaime thing though, where I thought the Game of Thrones version of Jaime not being able to help himself and going back to the Cersei at the end was sort of, you know, it's indicative of Jaime's character. Like, you know, he's trying to do good and he's trying to do better, but I don't think Jaime's going to succeed at that, ultimately. Like, I just, you know, ultimately that's just who he is as a person, I think. And, you know, I don't think he's going to be, you know, I don't know as it's going to happen the same way as the show, because the show completely ignored the whole Valonqar issue and everything like that. But, you know, I think it's going to be something along those lines where, you know, we're ended with Jaime sort of disappointing ourselves. But, you know, hopefully Martin won't do anything as bad as, like, the staging that they did in the show, where in the scene where they get buried in bricks, it seems like, you know, the whole building came down and they're just completely buried and crushed. And then Tyrion goes over there and moves, like, three bricks and finds their bodies.
That was really, yeah, they literally could have walked over 10 feet and survived.
It was, you know, as dick-fingered as most of the things that the show does.
I could easily believe that Jaime is in some senses an addict to Cersei, even though he knows she's harmful to him. And that even he could have years on the wagon, being with Brienne, being a redeemed, being an honorable, but that in the final analysis under extreme pressure that he goes back to her and you know, takes up the bottle once more. So I don't ultimately hate the fact that he's drawn back to her, and if they were to die together, regardless of whether one kills the other, I think that would be poetic. It's just how it was done, right? So
no, I agree. I think if Jaime, if his character arc does turn back to Cersei, we have to get a better explanation as to why, and then I'd be okay with it. It's just the show didn't give us a good understanding of why he was leaving. You know, he left Brienne and to go back with Cersei. If we got, I guess maybe if we were in his head, or if we got inner monologue during the show, we would understand more.
Yeah, I think that statement sort of goes for everything we saw in the Game of Thrones finale, you know? I tend to think that Benioff and Weiss couldn't make most of that stuff up themselves, so I think Martin probably what we got is mainly what Martin told them. So, but I think, you know, when it's explained and foreshadowed and set up by Martin as opposed to Game of Thrones, I think it'll look a lot different. That's sort of my thing on the finale, just completely in general, globally.
Yeah, I concur.